Hello and welcome to episode 6 of Book Therapy. I'm Rob Cohen. This week I took a little bit of a step back from some of the more serious or literary books that I read, and I went back to just the typical adventure story, something a little bit more light based on a recommendation from a friend of mine. And the book I read this week was called Pulse by Jeremy Robinson, and it had attributes of a lot of different genres that I have found to be quite entertaining during my reading history. It had characteristics of a Michael Crichton novel, had characteristics of a Matthew Riley novel and James Rollins novel, and it even had a little bit of characteristics of a Bram Stoker Dracula type of a thing. Basically, the story is of a billionaire who decides that he wants to determine how to find the secret to eternal life, and believes that this secret lies in the genetic material of the mythological creature, the Hydra, that was basically killed by Hercules as part of the mythological stories that we've heard growing up. And as I was reading the book, it was very easy for me to picture Hercules from the Disney movie and the multi-headed Hydra. That was one of Hercules' tasks as he was on his way to becoming a god. So this geneticist believes that the mythical creature, the Hydra, actually existed, that Hercules actually existed, and that when Hercules killed the Hydra, he buried its head. And he enlists teams of scientists to basically figure out where in the world this Hydra head is buried. He finally tracks it down, finds out that a gentleman who is a scholar by the name of George Pierce has actually located where the head of the Hydra is, and this billionaire, whose name is Ridley, goes to the location, kidnaps George Pierce, and takes the Hydra head with him. What Ridley didn't bargain for was that George Pierce is very close friends with a gentleman by the name of Jack Sigler, who happens to be the head of an elite Delta Force unit in the United States military. And this unit is called the Chess Team because the five members of the team all have nicknames associated with the game of chess. Jack Sigler's nickname is King. There's a character, her name is Queen, a bishop, a rook, and a knight, and each of them have different qualities, different capabilities, and this is the elite chess team of the United States Delta Force. So when George Pierce gets kidnapped by Ridley, the chess team is called into action, and basically they investigate the location of Ridley's science lab, which was in the country of Peru. Or actually, that was where the head was buried. The lab was in a remote island called Tristan da Cunha. And I don't know too much about that island, but when I read about it in the book, it just seemed so familiar to me, as if that island was the location for some other book that I had read, given the similarities to Jurassic Park and the Michael Crichton novels that deal with genetics and genetic engineering. It was easy for me to think that perhaps Jurassic Park had taken place on this very same island, but doing a little research, I was not able to confirm that. But for some reason, this island of Tristan da Cunha seemed to resonate with me as being a location for some other novel that I'd read. Anyways, the beginning with the genetics and the search for the gene that would create or allow for prolonged life, regeneration after injury, really had some key characteristics similar to a Michael Crichton novel, and so it was easy to picture this as being just another Jurassic Park type of a book. But when the chess team gets involved, this elite Delta Force unit, it really took on the characteristics of a Matthew Riley novel. Now, Matthew Riley is one of the authors that I really have grown quite fond of. He is an Australian author who writes novels basically similar to this one, adventure stories involving elite United States Army teams led by a character named Shane Schofield, whose call sign is Scarecrow. And Scarecrow and his team were involved in a few books by Matthew Riley, including Ice Station, Area 7, and Scarecrow. And then I think there was one that came out the beginning of last year called Scarecrow Returns. Matthew Riley also has a separate set of books dealing with the character of Jack West Jr. Jack West is a little bit of a Schofield wrapped up with a little bit of Indiana Jones. So those three books involving Jack West Jr. were much more aligned with kind of the Indiana Jones archaeologist turned crusader turned military who's fighting off the bad guys while racing to get to whatever the ultimate archaeological piece was in order to prevent it from getting into the hands of the bad guys, something like that. So the inclusion of the chess team into the Michael Crichton novel basically put the two genres together, the genetics and the adventure of the elite tactical unit. As the story continues on, we get to see a little bit more of how the how various characters are influenced and impacted by the regeneration efforts. In fact, one of the characters actually gets injected with some of the serum, which causes this regeneration. You know, we find that Ridley and his crew have been taking unwilling volunteers for the project, have been injected with the serum, and so that they can study the effects of the serum and try and tweak it to make sure they get it right. Well, eventually, as you can figure out, the Hydra head itself gets regenerated and it turns into basically a huge monster movie book with the Hydra and its multi-heads terrorizing this town in New Hampshire and the elite chess team basically trying to stop it. And of course, as in the mythical Hydra, as each of the heads is severed, two more regenerate in its place, and it becomes this complete and terrifying beast that needs to be destroyed, and only the chess team can destroy it. Otherwise, this entire town of New Hampshire will be destroyed itself. And in the meantime, they also have to try and stop Ridley, this billionaire who's trying to escape and take the serum that he's discovered actually will work, and basically sell it to the highest bidder or potentially use it for his own purposes. But most likely it would be used to create superhero warriors to the highest bidder. So not particularly deep, certainly not on the level of a Hemingway or an Orwell or a Dickens like I've been talking over the past few weeks, but a nice and comfortable diversion from some of those other books. It wasn't great. It was okay. The characters were enjoyable enough. I understand that this is the first of a series, and in fact, there's been a few books since that. I'm not sure if I'm going to read more of them. I may at some point pick them up just as another diversion, but having invested a lot of time in the Michael Crichton books, having invested a lot of time in the Matthew Riley books, and obviously having a lot of other books I'm looking to read, this opening entry in the chess team series was not so great that I was clawing to find out what happens in book two. So I might pick it up, I might not, but we'll see. But so that was Pulse by Jeremy Robinson. And some of the other reading that I've done this week was of the short story and poetry variety. And for those of you who know me, I am not a big person in the world of poetry. I have never understood poetry. I have never enjoyed it. And it's really something that I would prefer to do only at risk of some sort of great pain if I don't read it otherwise. But while we were at the bookstore a few weeks ago, I saw that they had the complete Tales and Poems of Edgar Allan Poe, and it was only for a few bucks, so I figured might as well pick it up. And while I was between books, trying to figure out what on my to-be-read bookshelf I wanted to pick up next, I decided to open up the Poe anthology and spend an evening reading through some of the stories and some of the poems. So let's start with the poems first. The two poems I read are what I think are Poe's most famous poems, The Raven and The Bells. And The Bells I only remember because when I was in 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th grade, something like that, in an English class, one of the members of the class had to read The Bells out loud. And I just remember the sing-songy way that the repeated use of the word bells kind of flows off the tongue. Bells, 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 the bells, 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 bells. I just, it resonated with me and I seemed to remember that. But I didn't remember anything else about the book, about the poem, and I certainly didn't remember anything about The Raven. But here's my problem with poetry. First off, you don't know until you start reading it whether the poem is going to rhyme. So at least in my reading of a poem, it takes me a couple of stanzas to figure out whether there is a pattern to the syllables, a pattern to the rhyming, or if there is no rhyming scheme at all. And so I find myself trying to fit my reading pattern into a melodic type of a prose to the poem itself, trying to determine whether there's a common number of syllables per line, whether they rhyme at the end. And so I spend a little bit too much time trying to figure out whether there is a right way to read the poem. The other problem I have with the poem, with poetry itself, is it frequently attempts to tell a lot of story by using the most minimal amount of words possible. And I understand that in a situation like that, each word must have meaning, it must have purpose for being in the exact location in which it's placed in the poem. But I don't get that. My reading tastes are much more to the longer pieces, where the author uses as many words as they want. They're not restricted by space or time limitations, and they can take the time to explain exactly what it is they're trying to say. But in poetry, it seems to me as if they're trying to hide the ball, so to speak, give you as minimal information as possible, but trying to convey usually some deep, dark, penetrating emotion, which in my estimation could certainly be expressed with twice as many words, if not more. So as I was reading The Raven, as I was reading The Bells, they just didn't resonate. It took me too long to try and figure out what they were portraying. But I couldn't really tell from The Raven if the character, the narrator, whoever it is that the poem is about, is hallucinating, if he's mourning the loss of a loved one. I don't know whether the raven itself has any type of symbolic quality that an ichthyologist would be able to express to, the lay person such as I am. And again, as I mentioned in the past, I don't know whether these stories, and in, with respect to these poems had more meaning or more impact at the time they were written because people were either perhaps more sophisticated, they understood poetry better, they understood the words better, because there is a lot of imagery and symbolism that it's not really used as frequently anymore, bigger words that are not used anymore, once upon a midnight dreary, it's just, you don't hear that type of language anymore. And so as a reader of that, of the poetry where that language is prevalent, it's difficult to try to grasp exactly what the poet is trying to say. So with that, The Raven to me didn't really mean a whole lot. I couldn't really grasp what the purpose of the poem was, what Poe was trying to convey. Certainly there's a darkness to it, the raven being a menacing animal, dark. It has an annoying squawk to it. So I can understand just by the use of the raven in the poem that this isn't an uplifting and happy type of a poem. But other than that, I really struggled with it. As far as The Bells, I had a similar difficulty reading this poem. Part of it was because I did have that sing-songy melody in my head every time those repeated bells would come up. But I got a little bit more out of it, I think, because each of the stanzas of the poem seemed to address a different type of a bell. The first one being the silver bell, meaning something of merry, and it's a happy occasion. And then the second stanza talks about wedding bells and how it's so happy and how everything seems to be floating and turtle doves and things like that. This, what he says, what a gush of euphony voluminously wells. I don't know what that means, but it sounds like it's a happy type of a thing. The third stanza deals with alarm bells, and this where it seems to be portending some sort of terror or some sort of horror, in a clamorous appealing to the mercy of the fire. That obviously is not something happy. How they clang and clash and roar, again, it's not a descriptive of something that is quite the happy occasion as the silver bells and the wedding bells. And the fourth stanza deals with the tolling of the iron bells, and it talks about the silence of the night and how we shiver with affright. And again, the idea that these bells now are portending something quite dastardly and nightmarish. I guess from this one, as compared with The Raven, I got a little bit more out of it because the terminology used as far as to describe the bells seemed to be much easier to grasp, being light or dark. The use of the silver bells, merriment, and the wedding bells, and happiness even uses that word at least once. And then the alarm bells and the iron bells getting the grasp. But basically a bell, which is something that is commonplace in everyday life, could certainly have different types of connotations to them, different types of impacts on the soul, depending upon what situation you're in when the bell is tolled, and how your mindset is, I guess, as the bell is ringing. So from that standpoint, I enjoyed that poem a little bit more. I mean, it's easier to see in stanza one when he's talking about the silver bells that there's this happy jingling and tinkling of the bells, as he calls it. So when we do in my mind, the sing-songiness of the bells, 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 it's somewhat comedic, it's somewhat happy, it's somewhat joyful. And then as we get to the final stanza with the iron bells, and it really takes on a much more nightmarish and dark quality when the sing-song of the bells, 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 bells requires, a slower down pace and a much more whispered type of a tone. In that respect, I guess, I can see a little bit of the majesty of poetry and what people really gravitate towards, because just from the sparse using of the words themselves, obviously this poem is not of any great length compared with novels or short stories. So the use of the words has a dramatic impact on the flow of the stanzas. But I am amazed at how so much darkness or lightness can be created by the use of such few words, and how the reading of it takes on a life of its own, so to speak, depending upon the usage of these words. So I can see from the reading of the bells that there really is some majesty to the poetry process. As far as The Raven, I'm just going to have to read that one again and maybe really sit and study it a little bit longer, because I didn't get it. It really was somewhat lost on me. Now, other than those two poems, I also read two of the short stories, and I do intend to go back and read some of the other short stories as well. The short stories I read were The Mask of the Red Death and The Telltale Heart. I had previously discussed The Cask of Amontillado. That's in this anthology as well. I didn't read it again. That one just provides its own nightmares for a completely different reason than Poe, I think, would have intended. But The Mask of the Red Death and The Telltale Heart, I'd read The Telltale Heart before. I didn't remember too much about it. I did remember, though, whatever book it was in that we read from, I remember an illustration, and the illustration was some sort of a room where there was a bed, and there was a floorboard, and underneath the floorboard, which was a very narrow space between the floor and, I guess, the foundation of the house or the apartment, was, I don't know if it was I can't remember, it was a skeleton head or a heart or something like that to promote the symbolism from the story itself, that the heart was beating, even though the main character had killed this poor person who was laying in bed. So The Telltale Heart, obviously, if you remember or don't remember, is a story of a man who, he had decided to kill a man, goes to the man's house, has it all figured out how he's going to do it while the man is sleeping, gets a little bit disrupted while the man is sleeping from killing him, because the man stirs, he kind of wakes up, and so the main character has to improvise a little bit. He does the killing, and then the police come. And the police come not to invest, they don't know that he did anything wrong. The police come because a neighbor heard a screaming, which was the screaming of the main character's victim. After he had killed the victim, he chopped him up, I think it was, and then buried him, or dug up the floorboards and put the remains underneath the floorboards. And then when the police come, because somebody reported hearing a scream, they come in and they basically don't interrogate the main character. They don't think the main character's done anything wrong. But because the main character feels such an amount of guilt at what he did, he believes that he hears the still beating heart of his victim as it's beating underneath the floorboards, basically where the police and this guy are all sitting. And over the course of a very short few paragraphs, the beating gets louder and louder in this gentleman's ears to the point where he can't take it anymore, and he confesses his sin. He confesses that he committed the murder, if only to stop the beating of this heart in his brain. The Mask of the Red Death, as you may know, is a story about a prince who decides that even though outside of his castle all of his subjects are dying from this dastardly plague called the Red Death, he's going to throw a big, huge party and invite all these people, and they're going to celebrate and party for hours and hours and hours on end. But despite the partying and despite all the festivities, at the end of the story, the Red Death still comes into the party and kills everybody at the party. And this one, similar to the Telltale Heart, has a psychological element. The unknown, so there's an element of this psychological being out there, and similar to the Telltale Heart in The Mask of the Red Death, it really all happens in the main character's mind, this brutal and devious and nightmarish quality, form, whatever it is, coming to get him despite his festivities and his partying. And I really enjoyed the two stories. I'm going to read more of the post stories because I'd like to see a little bit more of the lengthier stories, Pit and the Pendulum and whatnot. But one of the things that I really enjoyed about Poe's writing, and it's something that I've actually been trying to find in other writers, it's the quality and the ability to write darkness. The best analogy I can come up with is when I was playing baseball. And there would be pitchers who you would be hitting off of who, when you make contact with the ball would explode off the bat. And you could get some good power behind it. These were the pitchers where you were able to put the ball in the gaps or even over the fence. But there were other pitchers who threw what was called a heavy ball. And no matter what kind of contact you made with the ball, it felt as if you were trying to hit through cement. That just making contact with the ball took so much effort out of your strength that you really couldn't push through enough to get any power behind the ball, and you ended up hitting lazy ground balls that really didn't have a whole lot of strength behind them. And I was wondering how people could throw these heavy type balls. The ball is the same. It's the same diameter. It's the same weight. Usually made out of the same type of leather material. And yet some people had this capability that they could throw what was called a heavy ball. And the analogy I use for that is, or why I use that analogy, is because there are some authors who have the capability of writing a dark type of a story. They use, somehow they're able to create a scene or utilize descriptions that give this haunting feeling, that give the reader this feeling as if the walls are closing in. And they're not using words that are any different than any other writer. They're still using the exact same English words, putting them in whatever order they need to go in order to formulate their sentence. But there are some authors out there who seem to have been able to write with a darkness. And Edgar Allan Poe certainly has that capability. I've been trying to find other authors who have that capability, and I figured that an era of books that would be intriguing and might also have authors in that type of an era, capability for darkness, would be the era surrounding London and the time of Jack the Ripper, because that, just by itself, the idea of a Jack the Ripper has a bit of a nightmarish quality to it, a bit of a darkness to it, the cobblestone streets and the dark alleys and the fog misting in, and the use of, somehow, these authors are able to create these scenarios which give a darkness to it. One author that I found last year who seemed to really do a good job of it was Alex Grecian, who wrote a book called The Yard. It was his first novel. He's got a second one coming out in a couple months. And that novel actually dealt with Scotland Yard, the creation of its murder squad just after the Jack the Ripper killings had taken place. So the time frame of it was perfect. Somehow or other, Alex Grecian was able to utilize the English language to create this darkness. Another author I found who was very successful in that, at least in my estimation, was James McCreet, McCreet, who also wrote murder mystery novels that take place in a similar period of time as the Jack the Ripper, or maybe even a little bit earlier. But somehow or other, there was this capability of creating this intensity, but also this darkness that Edgar Allan Poe certainly had. And I haven't really been able to find it in a lot of other places, and I've been disappointed more often than I've been satisfied by the new authors that I've chosen. For instance, I chose the books written by Charles Todd. I think the character's name was Inspector Ian Rutledge, and this was based on a recommendation. It takes place right after World War I, and typically they're murder mysteries. Inspector Rutledge is with Scotland Yard, and the first book to me just wasn't, it didn't really do anything for me. It was called A Test of Wills. I've talked before about how I really revolt against the books in which the reader is not permitted to participate in the discovery process. And in this one, all the while I thought I was figuring it out. And then the book takes a complete right turn, and the main character all along figures out who the culprit was, and it was somebody who we never would have suspected and really had no reason even thinking about as a potential murderer. So for Charles Todd, I just felt that there wasn't enough of that darkness. There wasn't enough of that ambiance of feeling of the clouds rolling in and the dark night sky and the cobblestone streets and the dark alleys and things like that. I also, on a recommendation, picked up a book by, I think it was Charles Finch, called A Beautiful Blue Death. And that also takes place in London right around the turn of the century, turn of the 20th century, dealt with a murder and the discovery of the mystery of whodunit. But again, there was just no darkness to it. It was just a pretty much a straightforward police procedural, so to speak, even though it took place in the early 1900s. But so those two, books, and now they're the two series of books, Charles Todd and Charles Finch, I'm just not going to go back to, because I didn't feel the nightmarish quality I was looking for. Now, don't get me wrong. I am a fraidy cat. I get scared very easily. I don't read horror books. I don't really like things that go bump in the night, and books will cause me to have nightmares if they, impact me in such a way. But for some reason, I really crave the dark characteristics of some of these books. My favorite character of all, I've mentioned it before, is Harry Bosch of the Michael Connelly books. And Harry Bosch is not a light person. He is not an Elvis Cole like in the Robert Craze books. Whereas Elvis Cole is smarmy and sarcastic and funny and typically has a witty comment to go with his exceptional private detective skills, Harry Bosch is very, very dark. He is a former Vietnam tunnel rat, seen obviously the darkest places of the world, crawling through tunnels, has really experienced what Harry calls the abyss. And so there's nothing particularly bright and airy about Harry Bosch. And yet I gravitate towards that for some reason. That's just, it. There's a warmth that I get from that, as if I'm being included in this very specific and elite type of a group of people who are allowed to be brought in to this darkness that Harry Bosch has in his life. And yeah, I've picked up some of the Jack the Ripper books as well. Jack the Ripper, by the way, is a character which thoroughly horrifies me. And for some reason, I've read a couple of them. The fictionalized versions, nothing on the level of one of the nonfiction or attempted nonfiction novels. Jack the Ripper as a character is something that really scares me and bothers me. And I don't really like to read too much about it. Now, what's interesting is if you were to write a book about a guy in London in the 1890s who was killing prostitutes and his name was John something or other, I'd want to read the book. It wouldn't bother me. But by giving him the moniker of Jack the Ripper, it really is something that that bothers me. Now, I did last year read two books that were Jack the Ripper books. One of them was called The Dark Streets of Whitechapel. And it also had a brilliant darkness to it. The book itself was fairly poor. It attempted to fictionalize Jack the Ripper and give him a backstory as to why he was committing the crimes that he was committing, and followed him as a little boy as he grew up into this mass murderer. At the same time, the detective, the main character who saves the day, so to speak, has determined that there were, well, he was a detective in New York who was solving other crimes in New York, which were so similar to the Jack the Ripper crimes, but this was before Jack the Ripper. And so the theory is that Jack the Ripper was in New York committing similar crimes, then came to London and started his evil ways and became Jack the Ripper. So the detective who discovered and found, caught Jack the Ripper sort of in the first instances in New York, goes to London when Jack the Ripper has escaped and now is starting to wreak havoc in London. So the book itself was, not that great, although it did have some qualities to it that I really gravitated towards, the darkness aspect of it, although the gore factor was not something I was particularly enamored with. The other book I read, Jack the Ripper, was called Whitechapel. I think it was Sherlock Holmes' Last Stand, and it was a fictionalized version of the Jack the Ripper story, but with Sherlock Holmes as the sleuth who ultimately catches Jack the Ripper. Now, I think I should have been a little bit wary of this book when I saw on Amazon that there were two versions of the book. There was the unedited version and there was the edited version. And as I read some of the comments of the edited version, I learned that the edited version meant that much of the fantastic gore, dismemberment, disembowelment, all of the nasty, nasty descriptions of ways that these people were killed was removed from that version. But I don't pretend to be particularly squeamish, and I picked up the unedited version. And when I say that this was probably the worst book I read last year, that's probably not too much of an understatement, because it really did not further anything related to the Sherlock Holmes canon. I've read many of the Sherlock Holmes stories, many of the books. I'm not by any means a Sherlockian scholar, but I've read enough to be familiar with the characters and to be a Sherlock Holmes fan. But this book seemed to stomp on the memory of the character of Sherlock Holmes, and at the same time seemed to be a little bit of a gore fest for those who have some sort of a prurient interest in just nasty, disgusting gore. So that's really been some of my experience with the Jack the Ripper type novels, and that darkness that some authors have a true talent in creating. Another author who I've read a lot of, who seems to have the same characteristic and quality, is a gentleman by the name of Lewis Bayard, who wrote a book called I, Timothy, a book called The Pale Blue Eye, which incidentally is a murder mystery that involves Edgar Allan Poe while he was a cadet at West Point. And he's also written a book called The Black Tower, which is a mystery that takes place in mid-1800s Paris. And Bayard is just really one of those guys who has a strong talent for the English language, as well as an ability to make settings and scenes really feel dark, as if the walls are closing in, but you know that as you get to the next page, it will let up a little bit, or even if you just finish the book, it will all be over. But, as much as it has a nightmarish quality, also has a little bit of a enticing quality to me that I seem to gravitate towards. So with that in mind, I actually picked up a couple new books last week, hoping that they would have that same type of a dark quality. I've tried to find books that were in the same type of genre, murder mysteries, turn of the century, London or New York, One of the books I'm really interested in reading is called The Gods of Gotham, which just came out on paperback. And I think that also will have some of the same characteristics, so I will get to that eventually. And one of the books I just picked up was a new Sherlock Holmes novel. It came out, I think, last year, called The House of Silk, which was actually commissioned by the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle estate, or whoever it is that controls Arthur Conan Doyle's copyrights. So this was actually an approved Sherlock Holmes novel, as opposed to some of the other novelizations, which are just utilizing the characters without permission from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's estate. So I'm looking forward to that as well. In the meantime, based on a recommendation of one of our listeners, thanks, Phil, even though I have avoided it since it came out and became the worldwide phenomenon, I am finally reading The Da Vinci Code. I'm about a third of the way through, and after I really tore apart the 24th letter in episode 1, Phil could see that the 24th letter was a very poor knockoff of The Da Vinci Code and recommended that I read it. Now, I had resisted The Da Vinci Code from the beginning for a couple of reasons. One, I'm not really big on the event novels where everybody and their sister is reading it. I'm staying away. One of the books I mentioned earlier in a podcast, Defending Jacob, I stayed away from because it was such a phenomenon. I have not read Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn because it's such a phenomenon. And for whatever reason, I don't want to read the same book that everybody else is reading, so I stayed away from it. The other reason that I have stayed away from The Da Vinci Code is because I saw the movie, and I figured that once I'd seen the movie, all of the secrets of the story would be revealed to me, and the book would really hold no particular suspense. But taking the recommendation, I have started it. I'm, like I said, a third way through, and we'll talk about it next time. But so far, I can say I'm pretty much enjoying it. So that is it for this episode of Book Therapy. I am Rob Cohen. You can find me on Twitter at RobCohen13. On Goodreads, I am Rob Cohen there as well. And you can find me on the podcast website at www.booktherapy.podbean.com. And we're on iTunes. And that is that. Thank you for letting me lie on your couch.